and it sounds equally as beautiful as this machine, with no delay, so I can tell that it's got an RF link. So it looks like everything is working, so we're going to have lots of coverage tonight. And thank you, Eric. I'll bet you in the last week you have put, I'm going to pick a number, 8 hours worth of effort into restoring the machine to the shape it's in right now. Is that a rough guess? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
That's funny. I'm so blinded by the fact that I go there. I don't even think of it now. Is it just, a lot of things were broken that had to be fixed. It was a, the link transmitter, this computer decided it was no longer going to tell the rest of the radio to go into transmit. And that was a nice little chippy fix. I fixed it and forgot to do something to it, and so I had to go back again simply because it wasn't passing audio. There's a mod that I do to avoid the way we get audio out of it. And let's see what else. I mean, I had to prove that it was the antenna before I brought the management in, so to speak. And that was another trip. And let's see, we had a controller failure. We had a computer failure that deals with EchoLink. And although I had the IRLP running and covering everything for me at the time that the RF link and the EchoLink wasn't working. But yeah, it's been a few hours, I would guess. K2RIW, K2J.
Rather than go back to the site that many times in a row, Eric, you ought to consider just moving in a cot and sleeping there. Wow. What an effort. Well done. The new antenna, I guess it's a Station Master-like antenna, approximately 18 feet tall, that had to be walked up the staircase. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, the way that it is mounted in the little grid of antennas, there's no way to support the top, so I give it another 10 years before we get another mechanical failure. Actually, the problem with the antenna that was bad was, and actually got killed by the noise with all the wind that was passing through, it was the mechanical wear and tear on the antenna. I didn't get to see what the actual problem was that created the issue, because the powers-to-be wasn't going to bring it down in one piece, so they hacked it. And I don't know where it is, actually, at the moment, but I suspect I will get a look at it at some point. And I still have one thing left to do, and that's, you may notice that Selden speaks gibberish once in a while, and there's a chip in that controller that's got to get changed. K2RIW, K2EJ.
I think you did have a inspection of the input connector on the old antenna, the failed antenna. And I believe you did. Someone gave it a physical inspection and saw charring at the connector. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, we did. And it was black and ugly, and it was full of oculated, and it wasn't actually wet, though. That's the interesting part. And the female side of the connector, the center pin, seemed to have been spread apart a bit, so unfortunately, the landlord likes to use semi-rigid jumpers, so I think that played a role in it. Anyway, the jumper got replaced, and the antenna got replaced, and we were back in good shape until it failed again.
And I've been hearing the reports over the last few days of people in various areas saying, I'm getting coverage now where I previously didn't get coverage here, so looks like all's well. Okay, so we're getting a quick report as to all of the repairs that were made in the last week. We've got a check-in so far from Joe to B2RYY. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now with the word yes, and do wait for the four beeps. KQLIW listening.
KD2MDB, Bob, yes.
Okay, Bob. Sounded like Kilo Delta 2, Mike David Bravo is what it sounded like. Correct me on that one, Bob. Go ahead.
Yes, it's Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo.
Oh, I was close. November Victor Bravo. Okay, we got you, Bob. So we got Joe and Bob. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight? Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
WQLMM, Boo, yes.
Okay. Lou, that sounded like Whiskey Number 2, Lima, Mike, let's see, LMM. Give it to me phonetically, Lou. Whiskey 2, Lima, something, Lima, Mike, something. Go ahead.
Sure, Dick. That's Whiskey 2, Lima, Mike, Mike.
Okay, Lima, Mike, Mike. We got you, Lou. Okay, so we got Joe, Bob, and Lou. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now after the four beeps.
Okay, name is Hank. Call is N1YDY, and I have a question about feeding a J-pole.
We got you, Hank, YDY. Okay, one last call. Anyone else? We've got a question or comment for the net. Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
WA2SVM, Whiskey Alpha 2, Sierra Victor Mike, with a comment.
Whiskey Alpha 2, Sierra Victor Mike. Tell me your name, sir.
Handle is David, Delta Alpha Victor, India Delta, QSL.
We got you, David. Okay, first guy on the list was Joe, W2LYY. Go right ahead, Joe, K2LYW on the text net.
Very good, good evening. Noisy. Big one to hive in. Anyway, I sent you two particular website links. I don't know if you had a chance to look at either one, but one of them just changed for its reporting information as far as signal strength. They used to report it in dBm. Now they're reporting in dBuv/m. Specifically, what is that? I may have known it at one time, but it just escapes me right now.
I am guessing that that is UV/m is microvolts per meter. So one way you can rate the E field of a signal is volts per meter or microvolts per meter. dBuv/m is what I think it is. I think you said dBmUV/m, and I don't think there's a first M in there. So I think it's decibels in units of microvolts per meter. That's what I think it is, Joe. KB2LYY, K2LIW, and TechNet.
Yeah, I said dBuv/m. Now, with this particular website, you can move the pointer around and move it. You can figure out where the transmitter site is, and you get the pointer right on top of the transmitter site. When I reported in dBm, you could get the level to be something like almost maybe -3, -1, 0, maybe +1, +2, +3, something like that in dBm. Now the strongest I can see this signal doing the same kind of trick, I can see that level come up to a report of 116 dBuv/m. So it sounds like it's almost above a microvolt, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, the widely accepted set of units in milliwatts or dBm, dB with reference to 1 milliwatt. For instance, a 1 microvolt signal happens to be -107 dBm. Do I get that right? Yeah, 1 microvolt is -107 dBm. And that in the case of dBm, that's with reference to voltage you'll see on a 50 ohm line, a coaxial cable transmission line. When it comes to free space signals, the M doesn't indicate milliwatts anymore, it indicates meters. So dBuV, UV is microvolts per meter. A microvolt per meter, let me think about that. A microvolt per meter, is that a strong or a weak signal? My gut feels that's a relatively weak signal. The way you would find that out is take 1 microvolt, 10 to the minus 6 volts, square it and divide it by 377. Free space signals, you make the assumption that the free space has an impedance of 377 ohms. So microvolts per meter is actually a unit of power across a 377 ohm resistor, so to speak. And once you get that power, which is going to come out, if you square it in volts per meter, you'll be getting units of watts, and then you've got to convert that into either milliwatts or other units in order to figure out what it is in decibels. Let me think about that. Yeah, if it was 1 microvolt, I believe that would be 0 dB UV/m, 1 microvolt per meter. Does that help a little bit, Joe? WHYY.
Repeater, timeout.
WHYY, KQIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, it's kind of the impression I sort of get that it's decibels above a microvolt. It's kind of like an odd way of expressing things instead of a reading like dBm, which is what they used to give for a reading. But nonetheless, the second website is interesting. I don't know if you had a chance to poke around that one. That one, once you find the right link, will give you a picture, like horizontal picture of topography between 2 points on the Earth. And then it gives you like a estimated elevation between those 2 points. Kind of interesting, I did like say my house in New York, and you say your house in New York, and when you move further north, it shows a lot more hills, higher stuff between like you and New York compared to me. So it's kind of interesting. You gotta navigate around that website also. So that was basically about it. The first one was that was an FCC website about ATV reception and so forth.
Yeah, let's see if Eric is available. Eric, when it comes to defining a Class A or Class B broadcast area, I think quite often the units used are microvolts per meter, dB microvolts per meter. And roughly, how many microvolts per meter is considered a good signal strength for television broadcast? If you happen to be available, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Quite possibly, Eric is in transition from the repeater site. For all we know, he's in the elevator right now. Okay. I'll have to get a chance to look at those websites. Right now, my internet system is down. Internet I've got. I don't have the ability to send or receive emails, so that portion of the system is down. The next person on the list was Bob, KD2, November Victor Bravo. Go right ahead, Bob, K2RIW and TechNet. My name is Dick. Wait for the beeps.
Hi, Les. This is Bob, KD2, NDB. Thanks, Dick. I have a lot of questions. I think I'll start at one, and if that may be enough for the TechNet. Because I'm about to buy a radio. I was on maybe a month ago. I was asking about antennas because I'm in an apartment on a third floor. I think I'm going to be restricted to indoor antennas. And I was talking about HF, but now I have a question about 2 meter, because I'm getting an all-in-one radio. I'm getting an Icon IC7100. But I'm just trying to make sure what I'm going to get with this radio is my extremely limited antenna situation. And the specific question I have first is, will I be able to hit the Y-mark repeater in Glenhouse when I live in Park Slope, Brooklyn? And my previous experience is, generally, I just have to use Echo Link. I can hear you on my, and I have now an HD 5 watt, and I can hear you, move it around. Some of us get a better signal than other times. But I rarely been able to connect. But I did connect once when I used my quarter wave magma. That's the best antenna I have at the moment on my fridge, which is away from my window, maybe 10 to 15 feet. And I had a couple short QSEV. People understood me. They said it was a bad signal, scratchy, but they could understand me with 5 watts. And I thought, I guess if I get this radio, I could do up to 50 watts. I should have no problem. But I learned Eman Roy and his also Milan, who is the co-host with Roy on the Kings County TechNet. And Milan told me this, that Roy, and Roy, you can correct me if I'm wrong or phone if you want. I think you're there. But Roy had to raise his roof antenna. He was in Gravesend, which is maybe a couple miles farther out than me from Glen Oaks, probably that much farther. And he had to raise his roof antenna, which is far better than anything I would ever get, to get a good signal through Y-mark's repeater. So that kind of discouraged me. So it was my idea. We won't know until I get the radio, but if anybody can give me, educate my guessing a little better, what I can expect from that point of view. So that's my main question for tonight. So I think back to you. This is K2IW. This is KD2NDD.
Bob, all the antennas that you've used in the past, all the positions and radios and whatever you've used in the past to talk to this repeater, almost don't count anymore. As of last Tuesday or Wednesday, this repeater received a brand new very high gain station master like antenna, and all the people who are reporting to this repeater are saying that, my goodness, it's picked up a whole lot of extra sensitivity. So an awful lot of the testing you did in the past that didn't work well, redo it. So a lot of change has happened this week. You may be pleasantly surprised that your mag mount in the house is going to do the job. If you need more gain and you're not allowed to put an antenna outside of the house, could build yourself a 2-meter Yagi, and you'd be amazed how easy that is to do. If you go to the website of WA5EJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo .com, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo .com. He sells a whole lot of these printed circuit UHF antennas, but on his second or third page, when you get to it at his website, he will show you how to start off with coat hanger wire and simple pieces of wood and whatever, and you can make yourself a very high-performance, very inexpensive 2-meter Yagi antenna. And you can build a 3-element, 5-element, 8-element Yagi. Let me drop it. You homebrew that Yagi antenna. These are inexpensive, cheap antennas, so to speak. You'll be amazed what performance you'll get if you just simply follow his recipe. And once that antenna is sitting on a broomstick handle in your apartment, and you aim it in various angles, you'll find out the reflection off the building across the street gives you the strongest signal and so on. You'll rapidly find out what direction to aim that antenna, and it'll give you quite a few dB better performance than your mag mount antenna did give. So that's an interesting experiment. It won't cost you very much. You can do it almost for nothing, so to speak. And so you may be pleasantly surprised that with the new antenna at the repeater, plus antenna experiments you can do at your home, your internal antennas might do the job for you quite nicely. And when you do find that out, whether the news is good or bad, please come back and tell us what you find, Bob. KD2, November, Victor Bravo, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Hi, this is KD2NUD. Thanks, Dick. I do presently, I know you fairly like it. It's probably not as much gain, but it'll get me in that direction. I already own an Elk Love Periodic. And so I could probably, it would be similar. It has gain. I mean, it's my only antenna that I have that has gain, that's not omnidirectional. And so I try with that, and I guess even if I have to point it, like the direction ends up being more, you know, away from my window, through all the walls of my apartment hallway and the next apartment behind it, and if that's the direction, that might even work. So yeah, I guess I get an idea with my log periodic, that I guess yeah, it'd give you even more gain. And so, you know, I can experiment with, yeah. And so, given that it's, I guess the difference between 5 watts and 50 watts, which is the max I can get with this new radio, would be significant as well. So, back to you, Dick. Thanks.
Well, yes, when you go from 5 watts to 50 watts, that's a 10 to 1 ratio in power, which just happens to be 10 decibels more signal, which is almost 2 S units, so to speak, on a well-calibrated S meter. Do the experiment with your mag mount mounted on various portions, horizontal or vertical, the side, the top, the other side of the file cabinet, or wherever you're going to mount it. Do all those experiments. And when you do decide to also experiment with a Yagi, maybe a homebrew Yagi, that Yagi antenna can give you 8, 10, 12 dB of gain. The log periodic antenna, the good news is the design is very broadband. The bad news is log periodics rarely give you more than about 6 or 7 decibels of gain. So they emphasize bandwidth, not gain. Whereas the Yagi, where all the elements are tuned to the 2-meter band, will possibly give you a cleaner pattern and a higher amount of gain. So we've got a number of experiments there, and I think there's a high probability you'll find some combination that even on your handy talkie will give you good performance to this repeater from inside your apartment. You may not even have to go to the 50 watts, if you know what I mean. So, let us know what you discover when you make all those experiments, Bob. Next person on our list was Lou, Whiskey 2, Lima, Mike. You've got it, Lou, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Wait for the beeps, please. 2J, I'm back. Okay, stand by, Lou. Go ahead, Eric. Wonder if you heard our question with reference to how many microvolts per meter, dB microvolts per meter, is considered good broadcast coverage, Class A or Class B coverage, I think it's called. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, it's what's called Grade A and Grade B. Actually, Grade A signal, the way the FCC keeps changing it, the way they list it, the Grade A coverage is 36, and they list it as GBU. They used to list it as GBK, which is a whole other game. 36 GBU is considered to be a good signal strength at the edge of your Grade A area.
Okay, is DBU, is the U microvolts, probably so, and now that could be microvolts on a 70 ohm line, or it could be microvolts per meter in free space. Which do you think it is, Eric? Go ahead.
Free space.
So it's a microvolts per meter in free space, so plus 36 dB. Let's see now, 30 dB is a 1,000 to 1 ratio in power. It's probably something like 30 to 1 ratio in voltage. 36 dB would be 4,000. So it's 4,000 to 1 power. My guess is, let's see now, square root of 4,000. I don't have my calculator in front of me right now. So it's a good number of microvolts. And part of that is because the television signal is 6 megahertz wide. So that's a great big wide chunk of noise the television receiver gets, and therefore it needs a lot more microvolts than we amateur radio operators use. A 1 microvolt signal into a ham radio VHF piece of equipment that's working well is a medium good signal. KE2EJ for any further comments. K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Let's see, 36, I'm on my little calculator here. It's about somewhere between, I'm just rounding it off. I guess it's about, this is just sort of a rough guess, it's around 60 microvolts. the meeting.
Yeah, that's quite a lot of signal. I'm now doing a conversion on mine. And where's the anti-logging function? Oh, there it is. Maybe I did it wrong. I got 63 microvolts. I think you said 36. When you're working with voltage, I think you take the decibels, divide by 20, and then take anti-log. And so I got that 63 microvolts per meter. So that's a grade. That's a grade A coverage. Out of curiosity, what's the number for grade B coverage? Is it more like a 25 or so microvolts per meter? Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
Funny, Dave. When you do the engineering drawings, they give you the grade B. FCC doesn't particularly care because at that point, it's the point where the TV receiver no longer receives anything. And by the way, FM radio is usually 30 dBU. So you're talking about receivers that don't need 6 megahertz of bandwidth. You can get away with less signal. And the signal level is 20 log a microvolt divided by 1 microvolt.
Yeah, but even FM broadcast is a broadband signal by ham radio standards. Your FM broadcast IF strip, I think, is in the vicinity of 150 kilohertz wide, whereas the FM IF strip of our handy talkies, I think, is more like 15 kilohertz wide. That's a 10 to 1 ratio. So you could have at least 10 dB more sensitivity on a ham radio receiver versus an FM broadcast receiver. That's my guess on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, that 30 dB number is really good signal at your, you know, the major part of your listening area. I think they're listed as grade A and grade B, but I should know this. But anyway, I know that's the number.
Okay, very good, and I thank you for that information. So, we're going to go over to Lou now. Whiskey 2, Lima, Mike, you've got it, Lou. K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
Thanks, Dave. This is WQLMM. I was wondering if a large ball up entering the atmosphere generates any detectable RF along with its fireball. Like, for example, the Chelyabinsk, or the Russian meteorite in 2013. When that thing came ripping in, it probably ionized all that gas and served as a great reflector, but did it generate any RF, such as like an electromagnetic pulse? Because I think it went off with 33 little boy atomic bombs. So would you be able to detect that if you were in its footprint, wherever that was? I think it exploded 5 miles, about 100,000 feet, I think it was. So you think you could pick that up?
Yes, you could, but there's a catch. If you're using radio astronomy equipment and you're aiming it at that point in the sky where it's making an ionized trail, that ionized trail is a hot gas, and so a hot gas that is either reflective or absorptive at that RF frequency and running at that temperature is going to make something that shows up on your radio telescope. Is it going to be a electromagnetic pulse, a real strong chunk of RF energy? I think the answer is no, because it's extremely broadband. It's not concentrated on any one frequency, if you know what I mean. The meteor trails, the ham radio operators that do meteor scatter ham radio, during a meteor storm, you can easily talk, not easily, but with good skill, you can talk numbers like 1,500 miles. As long as the meteors are hitting a chunk of sky, midway between you and your buddy, whose antennas are aimed at each other and 1,500 miles apart on, say, 2 meters, that meteor will give you some number of seconds of reflection of signal. It's a highly reflective signal, that trail. But it's not a very strong emitter itself. As a reflector, it's medium good for the brief period that it's there. but a radio telescope could detect that signal, but it's not going to peg the S-meter, in my opinion. Over to you on that one, Lou. Whiskey 2, Lima, Mike, Mike, and K2IW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. Yeah, I've been doing a lot of past 2 years, been listening to a lot of media scatter, and then tried a little transmitting myself. I had the right beams up, which I actually just put back up on the roof. But normally it's just a listening mode, and I know there's a transmitter right outside of Toronto on 55239. If you listen to it in USB, you can hear the meter ping on 6 meters, and then sometimes you can hear them down on 14 megahertz. You hear them coming through, and it's cool to listen to. And sometimes you get them real loud, and for a couple of seconds. Although there are also hear, I guess, Trovo or sporadic heat with it. But the meteors come in, and you can actually hear them based on their Doppler shift, whether they go up or down, whether they're coming at you or away from you. At least that's what I think. But it's definitely fun to do meteor scatter. And, we got the amp up and running now, so hopefully we'll be able to do some more this season. But I appreciate the answer to the questions. Back to that. This is W2LM.
That signal you're listening to from Canada on 55.239, I am guessing that is a digital channel 2 television broadcast transmitter, and you're listening to that. The one thing that you can pick out is sort of a pilot signal, 55.239. Is that probably what you're listening to, Lou? Go ahead.
That's right, yeah, that's the television is the pilot ATSC, I think it's called, the ATSC pilot signal, and it's still the analog. There was one station in Canada I know stayed analog, and it was just under that, just under the cone of that, so we can't really hear it, except when there's some meteor either over us or at least in that direction. The best luck I had listening for them was when I had a 3-element 6-meter Yagi pointed directly at Toronto, and I would hear them. They would just come booming in, and sometimes, you know, they'd be very fleeting, and other times they would just kind of hang around, and you would hear, you know, that carrier for 3, sometimes 15 seconds or more.
And the carrier from the television broadcast signal station is on the air lots of hours on a very well-known frequency, usually with a good antenna on a high location, putting out a whole lot of power, so it makes an extremely good beacon. And so, in the Toronto direction, I guess that's your favorite beacon. I wonder if you've listened to any other frequencies in that area for medium. And by the way, I presume in this particular case you're doing 6-meter meteor scatter as opposed to 2-meter. And the reflection you get off a meteor trail, I believe it decreases at the rate of either frequency, 1 over frequency squared or 1 over frequency cubed. I'm not quite sure what it is. But the strength of the signal you get in reflection and the length of time you get the signal on 6-meter meteor scatter could be considerably stronger and considerably longer period of time than you would be on 2 meters. So sounds to me like you've done a lot of 6-meter meteor scatter, and maybe not as much 2-meter. And for a very good reason, 2-meter is a hell of a lot more difficult. Whiskey 2, Lima, Mike, Mike, K2LIW. Go ahead, Lou.
Well, you're right about that. I did spend more 2 meters than 2 meters, although under the right conditions, you can hear, I think it's WA1 or WA4ZMS in Virginia. It's 144.285, and you can hear that beacon come in every now and then. It's just a CW beacon, but every now and then you'll hear a meteor on that, and sometimes they'll come booming in too. But, I mean, it's much faster. You know, they'll say it'll last for maybe a half a second or a second, but on 6 meters you tend to hear almost like I think a friend of mine put it in terms of a head echo, like it would go zoom and then just drag out, like a zing. You know, it would actually literally sing, and it would sound very interesting, but on 2 meters, a lot faster, and also a lot more rare. On 6 meters, you can turn it on hear that television station come in many times per day. You know, it'll be very, you know, fast events, but it's very reliable. It's always on. So if you ever wanted to chase meteor scatter, you just wanted to have background meteor scatter noise, you could just turn it on there. And I mean, I've detected it on a dipole, just with the broadside to that direction, with an NFET antenna just hung vertically, and also the 3L Miyagi. So, yeah, pretty reliable source. From this location, especially if you're not blocked by any hills in the center of the island, point something south, and you can hear the Virginia one as well. This is W2LMM, back to that.
When I go to W2LMM at QRZ.com, I see a very nice picture of the top of your house, and I think what I'm seeing is a three-element Yagi on 6 meters, and then a multi-element Yagi probably on 2 meters above that. Is that what I'm looking at there, Lou? Go ahead.
Well, roger that. That is the, well, that's the old setup there. I actually moved things around a little bit. I took that, the top antenna was a 7x7 2 meter cross pole, and the bottom was a 3-element 6 meters. I've taken the 6 meter down and just put the horizontal elements of the 2 meter up, and there's a UHF and a vertical on there too. So most of the stuff I've been doing lately is on 6 meters. I've been with an NFED, which is an 53 foot NFED strung vertically in a tree, and that works not as well, obviously, but has a pretty good receive on. It's got some pretty good ears, that antenna. But I'll try and get some more updated pictures on that page soon. This is W2LM.
I bet you've had a lot of fun on 6 meters, Lou. 6 meters is often called the magic band. It's got a little bit of everything. Sporadic E and F propagation, and tropo, and aurora, and whatever. It's a little bit of everything. I wonder if you've been on 6 meters long enough that you can or cannot see any difference as a function of the sunspot cycle. I'm guessing the number of band openings on sporadic E on 6 meters doesn't depend on the sunspot cycle, but the E and the F openings probably do. So, for how long were you on 6 meters, Lou, and did you see any variation as a function of where the sunspot cycle was? With W2MMM, here we go, Whiskey 2, Lima Mike Mike, K2IW in the TechNet.
Well, I think I was doing it for about a year. I had the antenna up for about a year on the 6 meter side. And so I really can't tell if I've seen a difference over multiple seasons. You know, through the 1 year of the experience that I had, it was, I think, a little much, to be honest. I mean, that's not for lack of trying. I didn't, there were a few decent sporadic E events last season. But I ended up taking it down for the winter season because I wanted to focus a little bit more on the weak signal VHF stuff. And it was decent though when I had it. You know, I may end up putting it back up. I'm going to be chasing satellites again soon, so I may not have room on the roof for that. Over back to you. This is W2LM.
Okay, sounds like fun, Lou. And let me think now. Did we get a chance to answer all of your questions? Let me turn it back to you just to be sure. You got it, Lou.
Oh, sure, absolutely you did, Dick. That was good. Yeah, and the end was that it didn't get too much of its own RF to be really detectable, and that it still would serve as a fantastic reflector. So I appreciate the answer to that question, and enjoy the net. KQRIW, W2LM.
Okay, Hank is next. N1, Yankee, Delta Yankee. K2RIW, go right ahead, Yankee. Hank.
Thanks, Dick. And my question's kind of simple, I hope. I had a conversation with somebody the other day. It was strictly one of those draw on the back of a napkin kind of things when he was trying to tell me how to feed a J-pole that he's built. I expressed to him that I was going to build one. He said, rather than feeding it at the 50-ohm feed location like everyone shows on the internet, that I should consider feeding it at a 200-ohm feed point and run a 4-to-1 balun made out of coax to feed it, and that I would effectively decouple it without having as much signal loss as if I had a number of turns on a on an air cord coax choke. But what really got my attention, and this is perhaps where I don't understand what's going on, is that he had mounted, or indicated that he had mounted, an SO239 to the end of this coax balance, and he had mounted that at the short segment of the J-pole, in other words, the bottom area. And I realize the whole thing's DC grounded, but I really wonder, in the when you feed it as a signal, an RF signal, aren't you effectively shorting that out if the SO239 is connected to the shield of the coax and also feeds the 4-to-1 ballon at that point as well as the 200 ohm feed point that he was aiming for?
Now, I don't have a complete picture. An SO239 connector. The shield, of course, is connected to the braid of the coax cable. The center conductor is connected to the center conductor of the coax cable. And you made it sound like that is feeding a 4-to-1 ballon, and the 4-to-1 ballon is feeding the J-pole. And then you said that the shield is feeding something else simultaneously. Whether or not you're feeding the antenna correctly can easily be detected by measuring standing wave ratio. With rare exception, if you get a reasonable standing wave ratio with your method of feeding an antenna, then most likely all the antenna, all the signal you're sending down that coaxial cable, that transmission line, is by some means getting to the antenna. Now, there's various ways you can launch the signal into the antenna so that the mounting structure of the antenna becomes hotter with RF than the actual radiator section. There's various ways you can make a minor error or maybe even an improvement along those lines. But if you end up, if ultimately you get a reasonable standing wave ratio, that means you're not getting reflected energy. Reflected energy will not go into a pure short circuit. It's going into some kind of an RF resonating circuit, and it's either being absorbed into a 50 ohm resistor somewhere, or it's being radiated in space. So you know that you've got a reasonable method of feeding it if you're getting a reasonable standing wave ratio. Over to you on that one, Hank. N1YDY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I understand what you're saying about that. Of course, I could always build it and find out. But my question is, and I think you've, let me stop there and say, I think you conceptualized what I was trying to say, that you've got a J-pole made out of copper, pipe, in this case, a half-inch pipe, and 200 ohm point, it's fed by a ballon. The ballon is terminated in an SO239, and the coax attaches to that. What I was trying to say is that the SO239 was physically mounted just under the place where the shorting stub of the J-pole is assembled. You know, you have the longer side, and then you have a short side, and at the bottom there's a horizontal piece. And so my question is, from a theoretical point of view, aren't you also shorting the RF energy to the shunt section as opposed to having it isolated and fed at the wherever the feed point is, 50 ohm, 200 ohm, wherever you're feeding it in the actual J-pole, because you know, part of that goes to the matching stub, part of it goes to the longer radiating element. But if the SO239 is physically mounted at the shorting stub, at that T between the long section and the matching section, aren't you losing some RF energy there?
I've got a much better picture now of what you're saying. And no, you're not. Common sense would lead you to believe that the signal you launch into the long section is now feeding through that bottom shorting bar, so to speak, a signal into the short section. Not necessarily. The coldest part of that antenna is that bottom so-called shorting section. You've got the short piece is in the vicinity of a quarter wavelength long. It's got some RF energy on it. The long piece is longer than that. 5/8 wave, half wave, something along those lines. The coupling to the shorted section is mysterious. Some of it's going through the air, and some of it's flowing through that shorting bar. The fact that you're grounding the shorting bar to your coax cable braid looks like you're shorting out that signal is trying to flow to the small section. Don't worry about that. That's a cold area of the antenna. There's very little RF energy there. With reference to free space, it's kind of hard to believe that you've got energy in both vertical portions of that antenna, and that horizontal shorting bar, so to speak, has essentially no signal on it. And yet, that's the crazy way the resonance of that antenna works. So I think that arrangement is perfectly legal, kosher, if you know what I mean. I wouldn't worry about it. I think it's a good connection. It's a good way of grounding everything, Hank. N1YDY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
E2FIU input.
Go right ahead, George. I wonder if you've done any kind of hookup like that. You got it, George.
Okay. What I found is I had built something like this with a 450 ohm piece of ladder line, and the short underneath the feed, 1 1/8 inch below the feed on the 450 ohm piece of ladder line, was the representing the 50 ohm impedance balance. What happens in J-pole design is, if it's actually symmetrically, vertically built correct, as you're feeding it, one element is canceling the energy on the other side for one band. As it, you cancel and you go up and you wrap to the top, you have your lower band. On the other side that's shorter, you have your higher band. So you're doing actually about four things with an antenna of that design. You're shunt feeding 50 ohms with the distance between the two elements. Let me let it drop. You don't use a balun. You don't use an impedance reducer. The impedance reduction and impedance match is done by the distance between the two elements, whether you need a shunt drop of wire or you need the distance between the two elements in metal. So you cancel out with the shorter element the longer element to resonate that. And you also feed the shorter element to resonate the higher frequency.
I didn't know that people use the J-pole on multiple bands all at once. The particular design that you're following, Lou, your particular J-pole, I presume you're following a design that's intended for one particular band, not necessarily a whole bunch of bands all at once. Am I correct on that, Lou? I mean, Hank, N1YDY, K2RAW.
Yeah, I was thinking just of a 2-meter copper J-pole. I wasn't trying to do a dual band or multi-band unit.
Now, with exotic feeding techniques, yes, you can take standard antennas and make them work on multiple frequencies. That's apparently what George is involved in. But I think the majority of people using a J-pole use it primarily on one band. And that shorting chunk, the shorter radiator and the longer radiator, in that example, one is not canceling the other. The shorted element is a kind of a counterpoise for the longer element. It helps to make sure that your mounting structure doesn't become part of your high current RF radiating section. So it's a kind of a counterpoise when you use it for one band. Over to you, George, for any further comments on this. You got it, George, K2RAW.
It's easier to build this antenna resonating on both bands and both multiples of the harmonic. Keep in mind, when you're feeding it at the bottom, the distance between the poles is going to give you your 50 ohm shunt. If you don't have the distance, as I did with the 450 ohm ladder line, you drop below your feed point a bit of a loop, to give you that distance. Now, when you're coming up on the other side, which is open, it's going to be cut open after, oh, I forgot how many inches. You're going to cut that open in order that your higher frequency antenna is now going to outphase the lower frequency antenna. And if you want to make it actually a co-phase on top, a collinear on top, you can loop the top a certain distance. It's easier to do that than to go single band with a J-pole. Yeah, I did.
Go ahead, Hank.
George, I built J-poles out of 444, 450 ladder line and out of 300 TV twin lead. And I understand what you're saying, but that really wasn't what I was looking for. I was looking for a method of feeding an oddball single band copper J-pole, and somebody that I had run across diagrammed something out for me that he built, and I just didn't understand the RF thing. I think Dick explained it to me, and I'm happy for that. That the shunt section or the horizontal section is completely cold, so it doesn't matter that the braid is attached there before it gets into the balun that I want to use. And all I'm attempting to do is to create something that doesn't allow stray currents to run down the shield of a coax. So. Thank you to the net, thank you to Dick, and thanks, George. I do understand what you're saying.
And, Hank, where you're possibly also building yourself a belt and suspenders, so to speak, you can build an RF choke by taking your coax transmission line, winding a few turns of it to act as an air choke, just to make double darn sure that RF energy is not slowing down the outside of the braid. And, a fair number of people have used J-poles of the kind that you built, made out of copper tubing, and they're very happy with them. It's a rather high-performance, rugged antenna made out of not very expensive materials. We're going to go over to David now, the next person on our list. Whiskey Alpha 2, Sierra Victor Mike. You've got it, David. K2RIW in the tech van.
Thanks. This is Whiskey Alpha 2, Sierra Victor Mike. Just checking in with a signal report since the improvements that were done last week, and thanks everyone that did them. It was well worth the effort. It's a noticeably better signal here in New Jersey, here at the QTH, and it's during my commute between Essex and Bergen counties out here in New Jersey. I'm 13 miles west of the city, and it challenged the location for signals, and it's coming in really well here now. And in mobile, it's not too choppy, and I've actually been able to get into the machine better than prior to the problems that you guys experienced. So definitely thanks a lot. It was well worth the effort. And back to the net, WA2SVM listening.
According to QRZ.com, you're 45 miles from me, and you're sounding good. And I think you're a lot quieter in the machine tonight than you were the last time we talked to you. David, so, yeah, this new antenna is higher in performance, brand spanking new, never used, and so I think it's $1,000 worth of antenna that we're using on this repeater tonight. Almost everybody giving us a report that are very positive, so the machine is back to the way it was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, this repeater had really fantastic coverage. The antenna got moved, some of the coverage degraded a little bit. Maybe the antenna became damaged at that time. We can make some guesses. It looks like it's all restored. And Eric has put in lots of hours doing his repairs this week, and it looks like it's all
all paid off very well. Let's hope it all stays. We've gone down the list of everyone who signed in who had a question or a comment. I think it's time you go over to our science and physics section run by Roy, AC2GS. And this will be science and physics report number 21. Let's see how well we're copying Roy tonight, because I know that because of the last nor'easter, he had some antenna damage. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Roy.
B2GXM with a comment.
GXM, start off with your name and then your comment.
Thank you, Dick. It's Rich. Whiskey Bravo to Golf X-Ray Mike. I am actually reaching you via my HD from my living room. Was never able to do that before. WB2GXM, over.
Your living room is located in what town, Rich? Go ahead.
Thank you. It's in Floral Park near Jericho Turnpike. But as I'm saying, this is extremely good reception on the repeater's part, WB2GXM.
Very fine, Rich. Looks like we've had nothing but good reports as to this latest change. Let's hope everything stays that way. Okay. Once again, we're going to go over to Science Physics Report number 21. Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Sierra, K2RAW, you got it right.
Thank you very much, Dick. I'm down to my last antenna, so I'm hoping that you can hear me well. Can you hear me well?
You're dead full quieting into the machine now, Roy. So don't move that antenna. And speak to it in soft, soothing tones. You got it, Roy.
Yes, indeed. Well, let me do a little bookkeeping stuff. Once again, if anyone actually wants to send me any comments or questions or topics of interest, the mailbag is mailbag@justuseac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com, and I'll receive it, and if I can, I'll answer it, and I'll explore the topic one of these Sundays. I would also like to suggest a book I've been reading called The Death of Expertise. It's an interesting book where the gentleman kind of feels that people don't listen to specialists anymore and they take a gut approach to everything in their lives. So it's a decent read. And I thought perhaps we might discuss with you, Dick, your little question about the sun and the earth and the moon, of what forces are stronger.
Yeah, that's a very good puzzle, which I think I created it a number of years ago. To repeat the puzzle, we make the assumption that Dr. Roy invented a machine which measures gravity. And so at high noon, from his home QTH, he aimed the machine at the sun and measured the amount of sun gravity that was reaching his QTH. Then at that particular night, at midnight, when there was a full moon, he aimed the machine at the moon and measured the amount of lunar gravity. And so, assuming the machine has got a very good front-to-back ratio on its antenna and is really measuring the amount of lunar gravity and the amount of solar gravity, my question was, which do you think is stronger? And we were getting preliminary answers last week from Joe, Paul, and Bill. Most of them said they're fairly sure the moon is giving greater gravity. And their reason for saying that was because the moon creates tides and the sun almost creates no tides. Except for the people who have talked to me in the past and already know the answer, so to speak, which is cheating a little bit. Those people, please be quiet. Do you guys listening tonight have a guess as to which one of those gravity fields is stronger? The solar gravity getting to the Earth or the lunar gravity getting to the Earth? The variables involved is that by Newton's inverse square law of gravity, let me drop it. The gravitational attraction between two bodies is a function of the mass of the first body, the mass of the second body. You multiply that by a gravity constant, and divide it by the distance between the two squared. That's why it's called the inverse square law. So the moon is a hell of a lot lighter than the sun, but it's a hell of a lot closer.